Shrink Wrap Radio number 368, Couples at the Crossroads, with Drs. Daniela Roher and Susan Schwartz.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guests today are psychoanalytic psychotherapist Dr. Daniela Roher and Jungian analyst Dr. Susan E. Schwartz, and we'll be discussing the inevitable challenges that arise in maintaining a long-term relationship. Daniela Roher, PhD, has spent nearly 40 years in a career that has spanned three countries and two continents. Dr. Roher's passion for her work stems from a deep interest in human interactions and connections, and keeps her at the forefront of the new science of relationships. She continuously studies and applies treatment models that best help couples identify, understand, address, and resolve interpersonal issues in order to bring intimacy and deeper connection back into their love relationships. Born in Italy, Dr. Roher attended the universities of Torino in Italy, Cambridge in England, Wayne State University in the U.S., and the Michigan Psychoanalytic Institute. The experiences she gained from her studies in different countries nurtured her discipline and love of knowledge and her appreciation of the many ways in which different cultures affect and shape the human mind. From her many years of studying and practicing as a psychoanalytic psychotherapist, she brings an ever-deepening understanding of the human journey with all its challenges and rewards. Dr. Roher lives in Arizona, where she has a private practice. When not in her office, her love for the desert keeps her outdoors, not wanting to miss any opportunity to be in touch with nature and observe the miracles that constantly unfold. She is also an avid blogger on various psychological topics, with a special focus on couples' areas of conflict. To learn more about Dr. Roher's practice and to read her blogs, visit www.drroherphd.com. Susan E. Schwartz, PhD, is a Jungian analyst trained in Zurich, Switzerland, as well as a licensed clinical psychologist with a private practice in Paradise Valley, Arizona. With Daniela Roher, PhD, she co-authored the book Couples at the Crossroads, 5 Steps to Finding Your Way Back to Love. Their website for the book is www.couplesatthecrossroads.com. For many years, Susan has enjoyed giving workshops and presentations at various venues and has lectured worldwide on Jungian analytical psychology. She's the author of several journal articles on daughters and fathers, the Puella archetype, Sylvia Plath in the online journal Plath Profiles, a chapter in the 4 editions of Counseling and Psychotherapy textbook, and a chapter in Perpetual Adolescence, Jungian Analyses of American Media, Literature, and Pop Culture. She is a member of the New Mexico Society of Jungian Analysts, the International Association of Analytical Psychology, and the American Psychological Association. Her website is www.susanschwartzphd.com. Now, here's the interview. Drs. Daniel Roher and Susan E. Schwartz, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Congratulations, by the way, on your book, Couples at the Crossroads. We'll dig into the book itself as we go along, but I'd like to start with more of a focus on your backgrounds as therapists and the writing process for the two of you. So, Daniela, why don't you kick it off, talk a little bit about your background as a therapist.
Okay, I have been a therapist for over 30 years, both in Europe and in the United States. I'm originally from Europe, as you can guess from my accent.
Yeah.
And 10 years ago, I met Susan. I am a psychoanalytic psychotherapist, which means I go beyond the surface and try to get to deeper issues and emotions and the unconscious. And I met Susan about 15 years ago, and we've been friends since then. And we started talking about writing a book together just about that time.
Okay.
And it took about, the better part of 10 years, maybe even longer than that, Susan. What do you think?
I think it was about 10.
Okay.
Partly because we came to our own crossroads as well.
Yeah, and I'll be getting into that in just a moment. Susan, tell us a little bit about you and how it was that the two of you met.
Well, I'm a Jungian analyst, and I was trained at the Jung Institute in Zurich, where I lived in Europe for a few years. And we met at a seminar at which we were both bored. So we began talking to each other.
I know how that goes, being at a seminar and being bored.
Yes.
We found something in common.
Yeah. Well, so we have you two come from somewhat different theoretical backgrounds, theoretical orientations as therapists. And so I'm wondering, maybe you can say something about your background training and how that theoretical orientation shows up in your own clinical work with couples.
Well, I tend to, and this is Daniela, I tend to work more, I focus more on relationships and early attachment relationships that children develop with their parents, usually, mm-hmm. or whoever takes care of them, and the kind of attachment styles they develop, which carries through life and affects the way we relate to our romantic partners when we are adults.
Okay.
That's my approach.
Yeah. And Susan?
Well, I wouldn't say that I don't use some of that, but I also incorporate the use of dreams and unconscious material that is going between the partners when I work with couples, which is what happens when you work individually as well. So I think we both work at an in-depth approach a little bit differently. Do we approach the in-depth approach? But we really are focused on going beyond the presenting problem into deeper issues.
Yeah, so that's something that you two have in common. I want to go into this because many of my listeners are either therapists or therapists in training. So just to dig a little deeper, if I were a fly on the wall as you're working with a couple, what would I see? And what would I see, if anything, that would tell me that you're a Freudian or you're a Jungian? Daniela, you want to kick that off?
Yes. That's a huge question. I mean, we could have 3 hours talking about. Well, I don't consider myself Freudian per se. Nobody considers themselves Freudian these days. In my approach, as I said, is psychoanalytic, but I do a lot of work with attachment and also neuroscience. So when I have a couple, what I focus on primarily is how they respond to stress. Couples come to therapy because they are very stressed. And so how they manage that stress is absolutely important. And at times they are dysregulated, meaning they yell at each other, they are angry, they use rage with each other, they stonewall each other because they don't know how to address the stress in the relationship in a healthier way. So I help them at the beginning of therapy downregulate their emotional state so that they can become calmer and therefore better able to look at what the issues are and work with me. And because of that, I work at providing a feeling in an environment of safety with me so that they can bring up the issues that they want to discuss without fear of retaliation or argument, confrontation.
How do you get them to downregulate their emotional arousal?
At the beginning of therapy, in particular, it's all through right brain to right brain communication, meaning I lower my tone of voice, I speak calmly, I look at them in the eyes, I give them the message, I'm not afraid of your emotions. I try to center myself so that they see me being calm and they can calm down as well, that they are not afraid that their dysregulation is going to dysregulate me, because that's what they do with one another. They dysregulate each other. And so then they escalate, and then they are not able to communicate with one another in any effective way anymore.
Yes, and that escalation can happen very, very quickly, like gasoline on a fire.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they can become, and you just, one of them has just to say the wrong word or the right, you know, or the wrong comment, and they can escalate from 1 to 100 right away. But that's why I said, you know, trying to explain things to them and, you know, speak in a rational way is really kind of a waste of time when they are so aroused. And so it's through body language that you can really communicate, it's okay, you're safe, you're okay here, you can calm down.
Okay. And Susan, I'm a fly on the wall, and I'm wondering what might be distinctive that would suggest that you are a Jungian or a neo-Jungian, however you want to characterize it.
Right, right. I think I'm more Jungian rather than neo. But on the other hand, I want to add a bit to what Daniela was saying, in that you could tell that it would be a Jungian approach, one, by the use of dreams. So I actually encourage people to bring their dreams into the sessions. They don't tell each other, they bring them into the session, and we all talk about it, which actually helps people understand each other and brings the emotion into a place where everyone can hear each other, not right away, but over time. Yes. And I think one of the things that Daniela was saying as well with the dysregulation would relate also to the word transference and counter-transference. So how I am reacting to each of the people and the couple, so there's a lot of people in the room actually, gives them a modeling of how to accept each other, how to explain themselves, how to communicate clearer. And so there's where I think that the transference is, and counter-transference is very important.
Now, when you say there are a lot of people in the room, I assume you're suggesting that not only are there the three objective bodies in the room, but there are various unconscious components, projections, and counter-transferences.
Yes, yes. And I actually say that. I say, you know, there's more than just the three of us in the room. There are all of the unconscious parts that we have hanging around that are participating as well. So I think a little explanation, kind of normalizing in a way what has gone off and bringing it back to something not to be intellectual, but to be humane about what is going on psychologically.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I really like about your book is that in the preface, you share that this joint writing project has had many of the qualities of the couple's relationship that you're writing about, including initial excitement or infatuation and eventual difficulties and then finding resolution. And I really love the way that that becomes kind of the backdrop for the book.
Yes, because if you look at it, every relationship goes through the stages more or less. And you mentioned earlier in this interview that Susan and I have a different background, theoretical background, which we do. So we had to deal with it. There were times when one of us would get very attached to a different way of seeing things or a different way of explaining things, and the other person would be attached to her way of doing it. And so we would have to sort it out. We would have to come to some middle ground. We would have to talk about the issues. And so it was like going through a relationship, because, as we said, it took us about 10 years. We didn't write this book for 10 years, but on and off at different times. So it became a long-term relationship with all the excitement and the disappointments that come with relationships.
Yeah, that's what I found really fascinating. How did the idea for the book come about? Susan, I heard you take a breath.
Yes. I was going to respond in addition to the process that Daniela and I went through, because I think the process of us and all that we struggled with together was really enlightening and educative for me as well as an analyst. It made me think about and feel into what I wanted in the book and why I did and what was going on and what our personalities were like and how we were dealing with things and how we were communicating. So I think that that was something that was a very special kind of offshoot that I didn't realize was going to happen, as well as really coming to the crossroads, which is a very serious thing. You don't come to the crossroads with somebody that you don't love and care about.
Now, the crossroads, say a little bit about what you mean by the crossroads. I assume you're talking about a point of crisis.
Daniela, do you want to say something?
No, you are okay. So go ahead. I will comment on what you say.
Okay. Well, the crossroads are small and big crises at the same time. You know, it can be something very tiny that sets things off, and you have to grapple with the fact of, is this worth staying with? Should I keep going? What am I getting out of it? What am I giving? How is this relationship going to work? And so the crossroads themselves could be quite deceptive. They could be a little something, but the psychological work around them is the thing that's incredibly important. And of course, that's what happens in couples therapy as well. People come in at crossroads usually.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I would like to comment on that when we reach a crossroads in any relationship, we question the value of the relationship, as Susan said, and any situation, any conversation, any observation, any comment can be seen through the lens of, do I want to stay here? Should I go? Because the premises that we had created about the relationship are no longer there. We had to find a new way of seeing the relationship. And so the crossroads are a transition between what was there before that no longer is and what is not there yet. And like any transition, it creates a lot of uneasiness, a lot of discomfort, because we are not centered. We're not on solid ground.
I would just add to one thing to that as well, which is that the crossroads are like the death and rebirth cycle in many of the myths and the fairy tales and stories of the world. They are part of our journey. And so that's why Daniela and I inevitably would have gone into a crossroads, as well as couples have to, in order to grow. They're like essential for the growth and viability of any relationship.
Mm-hmm. And because of that, they create great opportunity.
Right.
There are issues that couple have. Both people may be aware of what their issues are, but they don't want to address them, and they can push them aside and go on and do what they do normally and avoid them for a while. But when you get to the crossroads, you can no longer do that. You're forced to face them. And because you are in pain, you are much more motivated to work hard at addressing the issues. So we welcome them because it gives us an opportunity to move to the next level.
So in terms of this book, I assume you came to, there were many minor crossroads, as you said. Maybe there was a big crossroads. How did you resolve that? How did you get past that?
You know, one of the helpful things, probably, and maybe it was harmful as well, I don't know, but because we are both serious, in-depth people, and we had an excellent bond with each other. And so we were willing to take the risk to say a good amount of the feelings that we had and express our emotions. It's very risky, and yet it is incredibly rewarding. And you know, we both had to, I'll speak for myself, really stretch beyond my ways and really open and really learn and hear Daniela. You know, I mean, I had to do that. I do that all day long. But I had to, with her, who we were writing the book, and it wasn't a have to. It was that I knew it would be helpful to my own personal and deeper self to listen to what she had to offer.
And I would say the same is true for me, of course. It is very difficult to address the issue. Very difficult.
Mm.
But, you know, couples usually don't separate and break up because they argue. They separate because they avoid addressing the issues. And those issues get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then they reach a point where they say, I can't take it anymore, and they're gone. They're out.
Yeah, you know, this metaphor of the crossroads, and by the way, I salute you both for hanging in there and providing such excellent modeling for all of us who are listening. You're sort of modeling navigating a relationship over a long period of time, and in some ways, as you pointed out in this preface, it's a model for the marital couples therapy relationship that you write about. It made me think of the Robert Johnson blues song. I don't know if you're familiar with this country blues song from years ago, where he tells about how he went down to the crossroads to make a deal with the devil so that he could become a really superior guitar player. Well, maybe I'm stretching a point here, but at some point our marital partner or lover starts out as an angel, and at some point we find ourselves at the crossroads where we see them more clearly, and that halo that we had put on them is starting to look pretty tarnished.
Well, but I think you're right. What you're talking about is taking back the projections that we put onto somebody else and that we must own inside of ourselves, so that in the work with couples, and we talk about this quite a bit in the book as well, but in the actual therapeutic work, people need to take back, not need to, but they need to take back what they've put onto the other person, because you can't live projecting yourself out onto somebody else. There's the bargain with the devil.
Yeah.
That's why it has to fall down.
Yes. And you know, the initial infatuation is what gets people together. So they have to have this rosy view of each other, which is a total fantasy, has very little to do with reality. And we all know, and actually Freud talked about being in love as being temporary insanity, which is true, because we lose our ability to have good sound judgment when we are in love. But that is what gets people together. It's the glue,
yes,
that gets people together, and it lasts for about 12 months, 18 months. And then after that, attachment starts to develop. And attachment is a completely different relationship altogether. We feel safe with one another. We feel we have each other's back. We feel we share a lot of things in common. We have common goals, common directions. That's much deeper than being in love. But the being in love is so exciting, and it's such a high that people really struggle when they lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of couples, and we see them, you know, I don't feel in love with you anymore, I want out. And so what happens is that if you marry today for the first time, you have 50-50 chances of getting divorced. If you marry for the second time, your chances of getting divorces go up. The third time, go up even more. And the message is, if you keep pursuing that initial excitement, then when it goes away, you're out, you will have to continue to do it all the time, because it's what Susan was saying, is the getting to the crossroads and surviving them and being able to get to the other side that allows us to grow together.
Mm-hmm.
I would also add as well that we hopefully get to the other side, but we are not going to be the same way we were when we began, and we will be changed. And that is what makes people quite afraid. So they go, like what Daniela said, I'm out of here. This is not as exciting as it was at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Well, it isn't, because the projections have to be taken back. The work and the love really growing and developing is going to be a very different kind than from the beginning flash of things. And the deepening and the honoring of each other takes something else. And it teaches us to expand our personality in ways that we, of course, would never have known at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And I would add to that, if I may, that when we are in very close, intimate relationships, as I had mentioned earlier, earlier on when we were talking, we tend to repeat similar patterns of connecting and attaching that we had as children. So when we are in adult relationships, adult relationships give us an opportunity to revisit those relationships. And if they were not healthy for us, to be able to heal them. Because we can see our partner not as the parent who neglected us or abused us or was inconsistent and unreliable, but someone with whom we can develop a different relationship, because now as adults, we have power in the relationship and we can contribute to how the relationship is going to go, whereas as children, we didn't have that power.
I need to interrupt for just a moment here. I'm hearing a bit of noise in the background, and I'm wondering if either one of you or both have a fan or air conditioning going.
Oh, I do. Let me turn it off. Sorry.
It's okay. It may or may not make a difference.
You know, Dave, we are in Arizona.
Yeah, it's hot here, too, in California, but it's probably a lot hotter in Arizona. I think it is a little better with it off. I couldn't tell if it was Skype noise or some other kind of noise.
It's all right.
Now, you know, speaking of metaphors, you use the metaphor of an automobile journey throughout. So every chapter, the titles and all, they're kind of guided quite a bit by this metaphor of mm-hmm. an automobile trip. How did that come about?
You know, I don't remember. I think, Daniela, it was your idea. And we both thought that it was just, well, one, it's very American, is it not?
Yes.
Right? And also, it is a vehicle that contains people on amazing journeys. So I think it had to do also with journey and the mm-hmm. journey that a relationship takes us on.
And, you know, I don't remember either if it was my idea or yours, Susan. But I love the fact that neither of us remember.
Yeah. Well, it's become both of ours, you see.
Yeah. Oh, that's exactly. A good sign. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. It has become both of ours now. So it's no longer mine or yours. It's ours.
Right. That's great.
And now, actually, that it would be the point of couples therapy. In a certain way. Nobody remembers when X, Y, or Z or whose it was, mm-hmm. but that it's really both now.
Yeah.
And it has created a third entity, which yeah. is the relationship.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. The subtitle of the book is Five Steps for Finding Your Way Back to Love. So what are the five steps? Maybe you can give us the list of steps, and then we can go through them each a bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have them right here. Do you want me to just read them out?
Sure.
Okay. So step one is survey the road. Step two is unearth what is causing the damage. Three, unpack and sort your baggage. Four, rebuild trust for the journey ahead. And five, access the emotions that fuel your relationship.
Huh. I have a different list in front of me.
Do you really?
Yeah, well, it probably has the same meaning, but I took these out of the table of contents. So I've got number one, turn in the right direction. Yes. Number two, identify shadow emotions.
Yes. All right.
Number three, let go of excess baggage. Number four, rebuild trust and achieve resiliency. And number five, create connecting bridges.
Yes, you're right, Dave. These are the titles in...
In the book.
So yeah. These are the exact titles of chapter.
Okay, well, let's go through those. Let's start with turn in the right direction. Somebody take us through that.
Okay, at the beginning of therapy, if a couple comes to us for therapy, the main emotions that are visible are what we call distancing emotions. They argue with one another, they are frustrated, they are disappointed, they don't want to engage, they keep their distance. So we encourage them to turn in the right direction, meaning, is there anything else aside from being angry with one another or being so disappointed in one another? Are there still some positive feelings left that we can use to create a foundation upon which to build our, how we're going to rebuild the relationship? And we suggest that couples start with kind of neutral areas that are not likely to start arguments. Like, mm-hmm. would you like to go to a movie tonight? Shall we have dinner together? Shall we go for a walk? Something that is an attempt to connect, a bid for connection, but at the same time is not going to talk about anything that could create problems or hurt feelings or anything like this. And it's important for people to realize that they still have some good feelings for one another. And we encourage each person to take the first step. Don't wait for your partner to do it. Because if your partner is waiting for you and you're waiting for your partner, you can be forever, right?
Yeah, right.
So be the first one who reaches out.
Okay, now what about step two? Identify shadow emotions as a Jungian... Susan, the shadow is in your ballpark.
It's in my ballpark. Well, you know, the shadow is really one of the hardest things to acknowledge. And here's where we tend to project onto our partners because we don't want to own what we are about. And it reaches into what is going on unconsciously with us. It also relates to something Daniela was saying earlier, which is how we were raised. So what we had experienced and then what we have put underneath and covered over. And the shadow also is not always negative. It can be positive qualities that we are not using. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot that's going on under the surface, which when people are just mad, they never can figure out. And so the wealth of material that is there could tend to get lost unless people learn how, and this is what they do in therapy, learn how to access what's going on underneath.
And I would add that there is also another meaning to the shadow emotions, and that is when we are angry, frustrated, or disappointed with one another, those may not be the real emotions that we feel. Underneath those emotions, there are other emotions that we call shadow emotions, and they are usually fear, hurt, shame. And we don't express those emotions because it's not safe to express them mm-hmm. at that point. And
yes.
So it's easier to be angry.
Yes.
Right?
And I would also add that this is a time as well where when people pay attention to their dreams, it tells them how they see themselves and how they are seeing their partner. So in a way, it reveals the shadow that might be underneath in the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. May I just make a comment?
Yes.
Being able to identify the shadow emotions begins a process of shifting couples from blaming each other to starting to examine together. Mm-hmm. So at this stage, if they are no longer making each other responsible for their problems, but they are starting to see each other as, well, maybe we are on the same side here and we have the same goal to try and understand what's going on, because if we do, it will benefit both of us.
Okay. Step three is let go of excess baggage. What baggage are we referring to here?
Well, I mentioned earlier how earlier relationships affect the way we relate to people throughout life. And so if I say, for instance, I grew up in an environment where nobody was really there for me, I couldn't count on anybody to be available when I needed them, I most probably learned to rely on myself. And so in a relationship, I may be detached, somewhat disconnected, not reach out to my partner for help when I need help, kind of be dismissive of my emotions, because emotions can get me in trouble. So it's much better if I use my left side of the brain and, you know, and be logical all the time. And so all of that could prevent intimacy from developing, because if we don't deal with our emotions, we cannot be intimate. And so understanding what the baggage from the past is allows us to change patterns of interacting.
Mm-hmm. It also, once people share that they both have got baggage, it cuts down on you did, she did, he did, whatever was going on. And it causes one to have to own their own self, really, their total self. And it, Jung refers to this in a way where the sins of the parents go to the third and the fourth generation. And we're all subject to that. You know, what did we inherit? What is going on inside? What have we expected that is realistic or unrealistic? And by sharing all of these things, it unites people, makes them come together.
And I would think that excess baggage might also include past grievances that one is holding on to, you know, all the sin, the long list of sins that one can recount about their partner.
Yes. Well,
you're right. And it also refers to having to let go of all the fantasies that we had about this relationship, what we thought would be and didn't, and, you know, didn't develop.
Yes.
One of the strengths of a relationship is living in reality. And that is one of the hardest things that there is to do.
Okay. Step four, rebuild trust and achieve resiliency. Well, it sounds ideal. How does one get there?
Well, actually, this is a one part that related to something that Daniela brought very much forward into the book. And that was the concept of empathy. So trust is not just in oneself. It also helps build a bridge to the other person, but you can only do that if you have empathy, not only for yourself, but for the other. It's an ability to imagine where the other person is and have feeling about it.
Okay.
And bring it out.
It's also the step where we address the issues of sexuality. Because usually when sexuality is like a microcosm of what goes on in the relationship, so if couples have had problems, usually their sexual relationships have been affected. They tend to maybe be distant, disconnected, not interested in being close to one another. And so at this step, couples are encouraged to address their sexuality, learn to be physically close, sexually close to one another again.
Okay. And then the last step is create connecting bridges. What do we have in mind there? What would be some connecting bridges?
Well, you know, the connecting bridges are sometimes in the smallest way. It's something that we had mentioned earlier as well. You know, the making coffee for someone is a connecting bridge. Communicating, spending time that is agreed upon. A couple of times a week, we are going to sit down together at our favorite place and talk about what is going on. and we will keep our relationship viable. It is actually something which creates consciousness between people so that they're aware of what is really going on between themselves and each other. But it is a very, it's like building your life together, rebuilding it.
In the book, we mentioned 10 bridges. And they are build the joint history of your relationship. It's very important for couples to be able to talk about their history together and what they did and the experiences they had together, and because that bonds them to one another. Share connecting emotions to foster intimacy. You know, talk about how they feel, not only what they're doing or facts or situations like this. Create a place for friendship. And more, reinforce shared values. It's important to have common ways, shared ways of looking at life and similar philosophies about life in the future. Be grateful to one another and show gratitude to one another. Affirm each other's significance. Susan said, have special places, remember each other's birthday, remember things that are very special to one another. Make a new commitment to each other, build sacred places. And again, Susan had mentioned that earlier, create the extraordinary in the ordinary. We don't have to, you know, go to Paris to show that we love our partner. We can go to a favorite place that may be 10 minutes from our home, but it becomes special. Mm-hmm. And then 10, moving from feeling secure with one another to increase our ability to reflect both on the relationship, on each other, and on ourselves.
Okay, well, thanks for taking us through those. Now, clearly, this book is meant as a self-help guide. How do you envision couples using it?
You know, one of the things that we had talked about was that we wanted to bring in information. So we didn't want to just say, do this, 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 and this. But we wanted to inform people about the aspects of a relationship which we found to be helpful. So we also hoped that people would read a chapter, make a time to talk about it, share their ideas. So the book would be something in between the two, kind of like a dream in a way, in between, so that they could discuss and talk about it and share their ideas.
Mm-hmm. I also would say the book can become the space, like our therapy office is the space where people can explore together. And we raise some issues, we encourage them to think about something, maybe think about something in a different way for them, so that it raises some interest in pursuing that more, in understanding more, in talking more about it, you know, searching. And that's what we do in therapy, and we hope the book would do the same for couples.
We also give examples of people from our therapy practices where a short vignette of how this one was and how that one was and how they interacted with each other, what they learned. As an example of this is how some people have done it, you choose how you would like to do it. Mm-hmm. It helps to have a model sometimes.
Yeah, but I want to add that none of the vignettes that we use are from people, real people we see. No. They are composite. Sure. Yeah, so we put information together to create examples.
Sure. So at what point should a couple conclude that maybe a book isn't enough and that they need outside help from a therapist?
Well, I would say that a book isn't enough to begin with. Okay. And I think that people can learn deeper communication skills when they're I think it's helpful for a lot of people. So the book itself would not be the end product. Hopefully it will encourage people to want to know more.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with Susan. The book should stimulate people to understand that unless they go beyond the surface, they are not going to solve the issues at hand. And so the sad part is that of people who get divorced, over two-thirds never go to therapy. And of the people who go to therapy, couples I'm talking about, who go to therapy, usually they make the decision to go to therapy 6 years after the problem first started. So, wow. Yes. So it's very sad that people don't acknowledge we have an issue here, we need to address it, and we won't be able to do it on our own. We need somebody to guide us. Mm-hmm. And they try to resolve issues. There is embarrassment, there is discomfort. At times there is shame with, talking about your problems to a stranger. But the problem is that unless we are with somebody who is impartial and who has experience in this area and who doesn't take sides, to whom we can say anything we want to say without worrying about, are they going to talk to some of our friends or family or whatever, unless we do it, we don't really give our relationship a good chance to survive.
Mm-hmm. Do you think your book would have utility for therapists? And if so, how?
I think it does. I like the combination of Daniela and I as psychodynamically oriented and Jungian. I think we bring in, we make it a journey, like with the automobile. We bring in this world of symbols. We combine our languages. We talk about the brain and attachment. So I think it's like a story that can be read and understood with technicalities in it and professionalism for sure, and also a humane touch, which makes you want to keep reading.
Mm-hmm. And also we tried to write the book in ways that is not partial towards one approach or another, a clinical approach, mm-hmm. so that if therapists come from a different background than ours, they can relate to some of the things we say. You don't have to be a psychoanalyst to understand the book. Mm-hmm. We try to be all-inclusive and accept the contributions from different areas, which we think are important because, we are so complex as individuals. And at times to look at things from different perspectives can actually increase our understanding of what's going on.
And actually, that's what a couple needs to do anyway, is increase their envelopes and increase their understanding. So the book, just by its being, promotes that, as well as all the examples in it as well.
Well, this was probably a good place to wrap it up, and that could have been a good closing statement there, Susan, but I'll give you a chance if you have any other final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with.
I would like to say that everybody goes through the crossroads. And at times in a long relationship, we go through crossroads many, many, many times. So I would like for all your listeners to think that if they are in a bad place in their relationship, it's not because they failed. It's because that's life.
Mm-hmm. And I would add to that all the stories of the world speak about the journey that it takes to become a partner, to become a person, and accentuate with what Daniela said, that the crossroads are our challenges, and it's the place that we really do learn from.
Great. Okay, well, Drs. Daniela Roher and Susan E. Schwartz, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you
for inviting us. It was
thank
a pleasure.
You.
I agree with Drs. Roher and Schwartz that their book would be an excellent conversation starter for any couples that are in distress. And as they point out, there are plenty of such couples out there. If you fall into that group, this book might help you and your partner get off the dime and start dealing with the underlying issues. As you heard in the interview, both Daniela and Susan take a very non-blaming, positive view of the process, seeing it as a journey that will lead to stronger personalities and a more satisfying union. Part of the reason I began the interview pressing them to describe what might distinguish them as either a psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapist or a Jungian analyst during marital therapy sessions is that they are so successful in their goal of writing a non-technical book that would not do violence to the other's theoretical orientation. What I'm saying is the book is written in such a down-to-earth, common-sense, jargon-free way that the underlying theoretical orientations are not all that apparent, except to the practiced eye, such as mine, of course. As a consequence, their approach is likely to appeal to both lay and professional readers of any stripe. The book is available in very affordable paperback and Kindle editions in the Amazon.com store. And as always, you are encouraged to order your copy through the Amazon widget in our right-hand sidebar.
Hi, Dave. My name is Dr. Michael O'Canna, and I am a medical director for an adolescent psychiatric unit up here in British Columbia. I've been listening to your podcast for about a week now, and in summary, I'm thrilled. You've collected interviews with some of the most exciting thinkers in neuroscience and mental health treatment today. I agree with the recent direction of your thinking. The age of Pax Medica is coming to a close, and a much more exciting era seems to be on the horizon. So, I have decided to show my support, and I encourage all of your listeners to do the same. Just hit that support button and show Dave that you care. It feels good. Thanks, Dave, and I look forward to keeping up with your podcast.
Thanks again to Dr. Michael O'Canna, who sent in this endorsement some time back. I'm cycling back through past donation endorsements. I know there are more of you out there who have chosen to help support this podcast financially. Please add your voice to that of Dr. Michael O'Connor's by sending me a brief MP3 of what motivated you to click on that donate button. Or you can use our message line to make your recording, and that number is 206-350-9918. I've heard from some of you that you're shy about this, and what I would recommend is you write it out first, and then you can read it. So, you know, speaking of Dr. O'Canna, he writes a terrific blog on teen psychiatric issues. I encourage you to check it out at teenshrinktalk.blogspot.ca. In his latest post, he talks about the teenage brain. So whether you are a teen yourself or have teens in your family, I recommend it to you. We have a new transcript on the site, I'm happy to report. It's number 208, Pre- and Perinatal Psychology with Dr. William Emerson. It's pretty far out stuff, I'll say that right up front. So thanks to Fiona Bales, who volunteered to transcribe it. It's great to get caught up with some of these in our back catalog. So thanks for your work on this, Fiona. Now, speaking of transcriptionists, you've heard me credit Gloria Ullman many times for her transcription work. In fact, she's working at this moment on my recent interview with Jungian analyst Nancy Ferlotti on Shrinkwrap Radio 366, in which we discuss dream amplification. In the course of that interview, I tried to relate from memory the story of a dream Hitler had, which he misinterpreted. I was trying to tell the story from memory, having read it years ago in the wonderful volume by Lawrence Vanderpost titled Jung and the Story of Our Time. I felt like I butchered the story during the interview. Well, Gloria Ullman, fastidious person that she is, went to the trouble of locating that passage in the Vanderpost book and sent the extended quote to me. It's such a good story, and Vanderpost is such a good writer, that I'd like to set the record straight by sharing that passage with you now. Vanderpost writes, and I quote, "I had been watching the rise of Hitler in Germany with a terrible foreboding, increasingly dismayed by the inability of so many English and French to see the phenomenon for what I was convinced it was. In the course of the slow, impervious, and sullen pre-war years of ranting out of what seemed to me always a tranced, mediumistic state, Hitler said only one thing that struck me as real, and that was, "I go the way fate has pointed me, like a man walking in his sleep." That and his own account of the dream, which purported to have saved his life in an alliance of unholy meaning for me. According to Hitler, he was asleep in an advanced salient of the German trenches when he dreamed that he was about to be engulfed in an upheaval of earth and mud. He broke out of this nightmare with the utmost difficulty. Feeling suffocated and fighting for breath, he stumbled out of the dugout for air. He had hardly got clear when an enemy shell hit the post and killed all his companions. He himself looked upon this dream as an act of providence, intervening to save him for a greater destiny. And from that moment, the conviction that he was under the special protection of fate accelerated the process of inflation to which he was already prone. One could not doubt, of course, that on the literal level, in its special context of war, the dream had indeed saved his life for the moment. But there was, for me, another dimension to the dream, even more important. I thought that the dream addressed also the most urgent of warnings of another kind of peril to the dreamer himself. It seemed to be trying to tell him that he was in imminent danger of being overwhelmed, not so much by the physical earth as by what the earth stood for in the imagination. Always, it has been one of the greatest images of titanic forces and urges of life that have their sources below the daylight of reason in some dark underground of the human spirit, as great trees have their roots deep down in the blacked-out recesses of the earth. This dream, I felt, could not be warning the dreamer more clearly that he was in peril of being overwhelmed and suffocated in an upsurge of some dark, instinctive, unrecognized collective aspect of himself. Unless he woke up in the sense that was an image of a process of being self-aware and removed himself from the mass, the crowd, the collective pressures of whom his fellow soldiers were the image and their sleeping state the sign of their unawareness of their condition, he and they all would surely perish. The dream seemed to stress that his salvation was possible only in finding himself as an individual. But content in the purely, literally surface manifestation of the dream, he neglected the cataclysmic warning latent in it. Reversing the deeper trend of his dream, he embarked on a course of rejoining the mass, the great mindless German collective compulsions to rally his countrymen round him in greater and more solidly congealed numbers than even the Kaiser had done. That one remark of his, read in the light of such a dream, appeared to me all one needed of explanation of Hitler and the Germans swarming to him like bees around their one and only sovereign. It was transformed at once from a dream metaphor into a proposition of a direct and profound scientific exactitude. He, Germany, and by hypnotic induction the whole of Western Europe, at that moment, I was convinced, were walking towards unimagined disaster in a nightmare of sleep. History was written in a way that did not explain history and threw no light on its latent meaning. The legends and myths in which it has its roots and of which the dreaming process seemed so dynamic an element as I had concluded in my amateur way. There seemed an underworld of history filled with forces far more powerful than the superficial ones that it professed to serve. Until this world was brought out into the light of day, recognized and understood, I believed, an amply discredited pattern of self-inflicted death and disaster would continue to reiterate itself and dominate the human scene. I had even coined a name of my own for it and called it, quotes, the mythological dominant of history, close quote. I came to suspect that this area in myself, from which my childhood interest in dreams had come, was connected with it in a way not understood, because it was itself the subject of one of the most dangerous errors in our thinking. We assume that without and objective were one and the same thing, as were subjective and within. I believe that they were by no means synonymous, and that there was something as objective within the human being as great as the objective without, and that the men were subject to two great objective worlds, the physical world without and a world within, invisible except to the sensibilities of the imagination. The dream of Hitler, for instance, seemed to me as objective a fact as a cloud in the sky foretelling the storm to come. The lesson I had learned in childhood, that no one could subject dreams to his own will or fancy, had gone deep enough in me to make that at last clear. Dreams had a will of steel and a way of their own in their role as direct manifestations of this other objectivity. They were incapable of any falsehood, only our reading of them was liable to error, and I had an inkling that they and the prompting of this outer objective within, and not even Freud's psychosexuality at its subtlest and inspired best, were the true source of mythology, religion, legend, and art, seeking and re-seeking recognition and expression through our several histories. If denied those by fair means, they sought them by foul, refused admission with a bland, not at home, at the front door of the spirit, they come in by force or stealth at the rear. Germany in the 30s by the day seemed to me such stuff as nightmares were made on, and everyone in the country goose-stepping towards an abyss in a terrible dream of sleep. I thought I saw the new German hordes in the grip of a long, unacknowledged mythological dominant, grown terrible and angry through neglect, and about to revenge itself not only upon Germany, but an entire culture which had been indifferent to the legitimate claims of the forces of this inscape within themselves. End quote. And that's from Lawrence Vanderpost, Jung and the Story of Our Time, pages 19 through 22. And I hope that the publisher will forgive me for reading this long passage, but I'm sure that they will understand that this will probably help to sell some of those books, if in fact it's still available, and I think it is. And if you would like to read this for yourself, at least the passage that I read, Gloria Ullman is going to append it to the transcript that she's working on right now, and I'll be announcing the availability of that transcript as soon as it goes live. Finally, in case you live anywhere near Rohnert Park, California, I will be giving a presentation on how to use the free cross-platform cloud-based computer program known as Dropbox. And I'll be giving this presentation next week to the North Coast Macintosh Users Group at the Senior Center in Rohnert Park, California, 7 p.m. Tuesday evening on September 17, 2013.
Hi, this is Dr. Robert Moss, a clinical psychologist and personality theorist, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Bob Moss, who will be my next guest, and more about that in a moment. But first, let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. And, in fact, the first person we hear from is Jungian analyst Nancy Ferlotti, to whom I sent a copy of that long passage that I just read from Lawrence Vanderpost. And Nancy responds with, "Hi, David. This is certainly a powerful statement by Vanderpost and a very revealing dream by Hitler. Of course, Hitler made sense out of it to support his complex, his identification with the self, capital S. When one identifies with the capital S self, one is no longer an individual but a collective person, carried along by the stream of unconscious forces, in this case, playing out the will of the greater German shadow, which was under the rule of Wotan, the Germanic god. Jung writes clearly about this phenomenon and the German psyche in particular in C.G. Jung's Speaking and in Collected Works, Volume 10, Civilization in Transition, Part 3. Or it might be Part 111, I'm not sure. He has a number of papers there, one called Wotan, another called After the Catastrophe. This concept was, of course, the basis for his Book of Job. Eric Neumann takes it up in a big way, too, that led him to write his book before Jung's, The New Ethic. It's important to see how the psyche works at this level. It is rampant today with our general unconsciousness, and dreams do throw us into turmoil, hoping to get us to question our thinking and behavior, to wake us up to see the false reality we have created and preserve. It wants to guide us, but unfortunately, most people don't really listen or don't know what to do with their dreams. The Jung-Neumann correspondence is almost finished and will be published hopefully next year. It takes up the Nazi issue in an important way. Neumann was a Jew from Berlin who moved to Israel and was one of Jung's brightest and most independent colleagues. So much to think about. Thanks for sending this piece. Best, Nancy. So it was great to get this additional illumination from Nancy Ferlotti after I had already prepared that part of the podcast in which I read that long excerpt from Vanderpost. So thank you very much for that, Nancy Ferlotti. Next, we hear from Lynn in the UK, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. As a, quotes, person-centered psychotherapy, close quote, MSc student in the UK, MSc, I'm not sure what that, some kind of master's, S, I don't know what it is, C is probably counselor. I've been really enjoying your podcast, and I wonder if you would consider interviewing Dave Mearns or Brian Thorne. Brian especially has looked at spirituality within the person-centered approach, and it would be great to hear a podcast with either of them. Best wishes, Lynn." Thanks for those two suggestions, Lynn. I have added them to my already long and growing list of listener-suggested guests. Next, we hear from Lourdes in Hawaii, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Good chatting with you, too. I'm also impressed with your warmth and aloha that comes over the airwaves. It will be an honor to do a plug for your show. I hope it will keep on going, teaching, educating, helping us broaden our perspectives, and allowing us to feel proud to be in this mental health profession for a long time. Take care and aloha, Lourdes." And Lourdes is a licensed marriage and family therapist in Hawaii. And similarly, here's one from Alberta, who posted in the comments area of episode number 297, also talking about possibly contributing to the show, and writes, "Wow, Dr. Dave, I just discovered you thanks to my friend Dean Mason. I've just heard a financial request, and it hadn't occurred to me that all these fabulous gifts aren't just falling from the sky. As of payday, I want to pledge my allegiance then and every month. Thank you so much. I love your aura and everything you've brought to us all." Well, I love that one so much. Even though it was posted in the comments area, I thought it was delightfully expressed. And I don't know when your payday is, Alberta, but I'll be looking for that contribution. And here's one last one from Guy, or would it be Guy in Quebec? Or would it be Quebec? Who writes, "Hi, as a human being first and part-time psychologist from Quebec, Canada, I greatly appreciate your interviews. A pure delight. Have you ever considered to interview Dr. Richard Crowley? He wrote a book called Mental Ball, Beat Your Invisible Opponent at His Own Game in 2006. His method is in complete line with some of your interests, like mind-body relations, and mostly is very interesting, practically speaking. I see his method as a very short therapy, kind of. I thank you for taking time to read my email," and that's from Guy, or it could be Guy Fredette, psychologist up in Quebec. So thank you for that suggestion, Guy. And as you heard me say, I'll add it to my long and growing list of listener suggestions. And then that's got to be folded in with my own ideas. I've got some places I want to go too. But I do really appreciate the suggestions I get from listeners. And in many instances, they have guided me and turned me on to guests that I never would have known of. So it kind of helps to keep me on my growing edge. So I think we better wrap it up today with that. As always, you can send email to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks again to today's guests, Drs. Daniela Roher and Suzanne Schwartz, for their insights on working with couples at the crossroads. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Dr. Robert A. Moss, who will be telling us about his psychobiological theory and how it potentially sheds light on the conduct of psychotherapy. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.